You are listening to Eastside Radio Podcast.
89.7 FM, Eastside Radio.
Every breath you take, every move you make, every bond you break, every step you take, I'll be watching you.
Every breath you take. Well, talking about breaths we take, we all remember COVID, don't we? We remember its outbreak. We remember the devastation that it inflicted on populations across the globe. We remember the political outfall. We remembered how it impacted our lives and the legacy it left behind. But perhaps what we're not quite so across is what it took to identify the actual virus, to break it down and to come up with some solutions to conquer it. We tend to simply cross our fingers in the hope that someone, somewhere, will come to grips with what it is and how to knock it off. Well, what if I told you that a professor of virology at the University of Sydney was the first to publicly release the genomic sequence of the virus causing COVID-19? That led to global collaboration, which developed vaccines and tests that were adopted internationally. His work to identify the viruses, improve diagnostics, and better understand how infectious disease epidemics emerge has been recognised through the 2025 GSK Award for Research Excellence. And that person is Professor Eddie Holmes. Professor Holmes, welcome to Monday Drive.
Hi, Adam.
Professor Holmes, not all of us know a lot about virology. Tell us what virology is.
I think Carl Orff and Carmina Burana kind of summed it quite well, really. It's the kind of relentless and unpredictable thing that viruses come every so often and we just have to live with it. So virology is a study of viruses. Viruses are tiny microscopic agents. Some people say they're living, some people say they're not living. I think they are living. And basically, the defining feature of viruses is it parasitizes a host cell. It can't survive without being in a host. Right. And normally viruses, to be honest with you, most viruses in nature, which there are millions and millions, don't do anything at all. Very occasionally, though, they can jump into between species, and sometimes that can cause a serious disease and a pandemic like we have with COVID.
Right. You were awarded the Prime Minister's Prize for Science in 2023. That was Albanese's, when Albanese was Prime Minister. Well, he still is, of course. Do you think he has a clue what virology is?
I've not actually talked to him. Actually, in fact, it was Scott Morrison. I think it was 2021, and Scott Morrison was the person who awarded me the prize, although because of COVID.
Do you think he knew any more?
Well, you know, look, I will get critical later on, I think, but I think Australia, to be honest with you, Anne, I think we should be bless ourselves living in Australia actually during COVID, because whatever your political persuasion may be, I think the past government under Morrison handled COVID pretty well actually, and the thing they did was listen to the scientific advice in a kind of clear way. So I think, you know, on that score, well, they did okay.
Well, I think you have made your first political comment, because I had Malcolm Turnbull in this studio not so long ago, and he said that it was a fairly hideous mistake that Morrison made by not rolling out your vaccines earlier.
The one thing I think you can criticise them on, and I think Mr. Turnbull was correct, is the vaccine rollout. And very famously, Scott Morrison said, it's not a race.
It's not a race.
It absolutely is a race. It's the biggest race of all. Yeah. You know, other than that, I mean, that was a mistake made, and a mistake. Although, despite that, if you look at any metric of how countries did in the pandemic, you look at the cost of the economy, which obviously is devastating to many people, lost their jobs.
Yeah.
But if you look at that comparatively across the world, you look at COVID deaths, okay, in cases, Australia turned out very well. Okay. And if you compare what our experience to that, to my colleagues in Northern Hemisphere, it's chalk and cheese, quite frankly.
Do you think that the variation in treatments by state premiers had any influence. In other words, was Victoria better managed than other states, given the impact of what the Premier did down there?
No, I don't know. I think it's hard. You can if you roll the dice, we do the same thing again. I don't really know. The difference between obviously New South Wales and Victoria is they just had more outbreaks than we did, right? So we closed our borders in New South Wales, and we were lucky in 2020 that after the initial kind of lockdown, we didn't get any more waves of virus. What they did in Victoria, and they had those famous hotel quarantine breaches that kept bringing out the virus. Now, whether the same, if that happened in New South Wales, would the state government have done, you know, done a different thing and same thing to what they did in Victoria? I don't really know. I think it's hard to kind of, you know, rewrite history and say what was correct and what's not correct, quite frankly.
Do you think there could have been a better COVID incubator than a cruise ship?
Not really. Cruise ships, but they're well known. They're well known for outbreaks of particularly gastro disease like norovirus. They're very well known. Mm. And you saw very clearly a number of major cruise ship outbreaks. At one point, I can't remember exactly when it was, but some early in 2020, the third biggest outbreak country in the world was actually the cruise ship in Yokohama in Japan. Right. Okay, so many cases on that ship. Mm-hmm. So yeah, confined space, lots of people. This is going to happen.
Yeah, you were the first to publicly release the genomic sequence of the virus that caused COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, and that enabled global scientific collaboration that led to the development of the tests and the vaccine within days of release. How did you do it?
So what the story, I'll give you a small backstory. So I've been working quite a lot in China, and I had a colleague of mine called Professor Zhong Zheng Zhang, who's then at Fudan University in Shanghai. And we had like a surveillance program going on in Wuhan by chance. I've been to Wuhan a few times, and we were mainly working in this place called Wuhan Central Hospital. So in December, late December 2019, the first cases, this unknown respiratory disease, reported to that hospital. Okay.
Yeah.
So then what happened was the doctors in Wuhan, they didn't know what the cause of it was. My colleague Zhang asked for some samples. They were then sent on a train from Wuhan to Shanghai. By the way, that train journey with the samples broke the national biosecurity rule, which got Zhang into a lot of trouble. They arrived in Zhang's lab on January the 3rd. He then immediately set about sequencing, what's called sequencing the virus, which means you get the genetic code of the virus.
Yep.
That took 40 hours from arrival to getting the code. And one of the patients we looked at, there was a huge abundance of this novel virus. And we knew immediately that was the cause. There was then some pressure in China for him not to release that data because the Chinese government wanted to kind of keep the populace in the dark.
They
control the message, basically.
They didn't
release the information.
Yeah.
He then eventually gave the genome sequence to me. And it's basically 30,000 letters in these four letters, A, C, T, and G, repeated, 30,000 times. Mm. I then got that. It was a Saturday morning, I think, in Sydney. I then managed to upload it onto a computer website, which took few minutes. We wrote a colleague wrote a little script saying what the sequence was. Then we posted it on this website, and I announced it on what was then Twitter. And as you say, it was a Friday evening in the US. Mm. By Monday morning, researchers at the National Institute of Health in the US and Moderna, the company, had designed the first vaccine, the first mRNA vaccine.
Mm.
Okay, and of course, mRNA vaccines are now under terrible threat in the US because of politics.
Yes.
So that was an amazingly quick, piece of science there.
Yeah. Do you think, in retrospect, there was any way of detecting it faster? Or is the answer to that limited by the country in which it was detected?
No, I think they did. It's a very good question. So if you look at what happened in Wuhan, so the doctors in Wuhan actually did a really good job. So these cases of pneumonia happen all the time. So if you go into any hospital in Sydney, you will get cases of pneumonia. So they happen all the time. They noticed there was a cluster. So different doctors at different hospitals in Wuhan realized there was a cluster of patients who are having this pneumonia. They then did the right things. They tried their standard diagnostic test that everyone uses, like we've all had, and they couldn't find out what it was. They then sent it to a local biotech company to be sequenced. So they were really, really quick on that. Mm. A little bit, the slower bit was a little bit in the release of the sequence, because it wasn't just Zhang who'd sequenced it, a number of groups have sequenced it, but there was really an attempt to kind of not to release that publicly, and because the Chinese government didn't want to instill fear in the Chinese population, because this looked just like SARS. Mm. And it was going around kind of Chinese social media at the end of December 2019, start of January 2020, that what this might be. So there's a bit of panic setting the population. So that could have been a little bit quicker. Mm. And then once it was released, the design of the vaccine and the first tests for COVID was done incredibly quickly. Yeah. So I guess the other point is, would it have made a great deal of difference if we had released the sequence, you know, a week early or something like that? And the answer to that is probably no. I suspect already by late December, knowing how big Wuhan is and how well connected China is, Wuhan is very well connected by rail and air and boat, but it had already spread to other Chinese cities by the point that anyone has sequenced it in the first place, quite frankly.
Mm, mm. You mentioned earlier that there are millions of viruses out there. How many of those millions have the capacity to do what COVID has done?
Oh, so it's extremely hard. Many people trying to estimate that number. It's extremely hard. Just to put it in context, there's probably close on 100 million viruses in eukaryotes, so things that are cells like us, okay? Mm. Of those, to date, about 250 or so have infected humans that we know about over our history, okay? Mm-hmm. How many of the 100 million could? It's a very, very hard question to answer. It'll be hundreds, maybe, okay? Maybe even thousands out there. To answer a different way, we already know that coronaviruses like SARS-CoV-2, we already know that in nature there are animals, particularly bats, that have coronaviruses pretty similar to SARS-CoV-2 or SARS-1, right, that we know can infect our cells, right? We know they're there. So the odds of us getting another pandemic like COVID-19 are 100%. The uncertainty is when it's going to happen. Is it going to happen, you know, next week, next year, 10 years, 100 years? We just do not know. But it absolutely will happen. And we just need to prepare ourselves for that, you know, that inevitable consequence.
If you knew back in COVID days what you know now in terms of AI and how AI can assist you, would it have been, how different would it have been in terms of developing
I don't think it'd been a huge difference. I think sadly, Alan, this is I go back to politics again. I think things have got a little bit worse since COVID's taken place. So if you look at it now, I think reasonably, given the techniques that we use and the techniques that I use and we used back then, and now even better, is two. One is called metagenomics. And what that means is you take a sample, and it could be a human throat swab sample, or it could be an animal, a bit of dirt or something. And you get the genetic code of everything in that sample. So you take a human kind of throat swab, it's our DNA, it's our bacteria and viruses too. That technique is now incredibly powerful and incredibly quick and generates vast amounts of data. And AI, which is basically a computer program, it's machine learning, yeah, is an algorithm that can analyze that data incredibly quickly. So I think it's very reasonable to say now, any unknown outbreak, you can find the cause in 24 hours, right? Yeah. I think that's reasonable. Now, if you wind the clock back, it took 2 years to find that HIV caused AIDS.
Yes, but that, you've got to qualify that by saying it depends on how long it takes the information to get to you that there is an outbreak.
Yeah, yeah, no, and that is the exact problem that we have now. So that's the tech to identification of a pathogen is very, very quick, right, and then from that we can make a vaccine very quickly. The problem now is COVID has become so toxic, okay, politically. Yeah. And so there's massive blame game going on between the US and China. Did it get out of a Chinese lab, yeah, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. All that sort of stuff. And what it's meant is that I know my colleagues who work in some of these countries, they're under pressure and they're reluctant to share data. And what worries me is the blame game is so strong that people now will not do the right thing and say, oh, I've got an outbreak here. Let's investigate it. They'll keep quiet and let it fester. And that's the worst thing you can do.
Yes,
the number one thing of any pandemic is to share your data as quickly as possible. If you don't do that, you are asking for trouble.
We'll wait for the next one. I'm speaking with Professor Eddie Holmes, who is a virologist and the 2025 winner of the Award for Excellence in Research. Eddie, if you can come to grips with COVID, and if you can use AI to assist in conquering other obscure viruses with the speed with which you've just outlined, why does the common cold still present such challenges for medical science to overcome? And similarly, the flu and, you know, just other various viruses.
So the common cold is actually caused by a very large number of different viruses. And we call it the common cold. But in fact, there are multiple viruses that do that. Rhinoviruses, adenoviruses. There are a whole bunch of these viruses that do that. And they are very genetically variable. And your immune response to them is not very long lasting. So if you get a rhinovirus, that's a very common cold virus.
Yeah.
You'll get immunity to it for a few months, and then the next one will come along and evade that immunity. So we're endlessly in this kind of game trying to catch up, and we just have to kind of accept the fact there is this endless diversity. We can't protect ourselves against it. Flu though is a much more vexing problem because it is also, to the common cold is actually, you know, it's pretty mild, it's miserable, but we're okay with it. Flu, very serious flu, can be absolutely devastating. In fact, you could arguably say that the biggest single disease outbreak in terms of death in human history, 1918-1919 flu, which may have killed, you know, 50 to 100 million people in one or two years. And the problem with flu is there is endless diversity. It's mainly in birds. And some of those avian viruses are extremely virulent when they get into a mammal, okay?
Yeah.
And at the moment, this one called H5N1. It's a strain of avian flu. It's floating around the world, not yet in Australia. That one has killed a lot of mammals, particularly like seals and sea lions that have eaten these infected seabirds. So... And flu is very, very diverse as well. So on the bad news is we don't have a vaccine that can protect against all flu strains. We'd love to do that. That's like a holy grail in vaccinology. The good news is for H5N1, very nasty flu strains, we have vaccines prepared if it ever does really become a big outbreak in humans.
Mm.
But so flu is the one, of all the viruses out there, what's the one that kind of keeps me up most at night, right? I think influenza is the one to, because it can be extremely infectious and extremely virulent.
Well, I have hopes that you'll be able to get to sleep a lot faster. And the only way you can do that, of course, is by finding a solution for it. So we look to you to do that. I'm wondering, is there any application of your work to things like MS and similar chronic diseases whose root causes may not be virus caused?
Well, so... You know, there is a little bit, because it turns out that some of these chronic diseases for which the cause has been pretty elusive for a number of years, and MS is a really good example, excuse me, it turns out that they may actually have a viral cause. There was a very cool study published a couple of years ago that provided very, I think, convincing evidence that a common virus called Epstein-Barr virus, or EBV, may well play a role in the cause of multiple sclerosis.
Yeah.
So a lot of these very serious insidious chronic diseases may have a viral cause. And I think one of the great frontiers for virology in the coming years is trying to see, do viruses, we all think of viruses as these short infectious things, do they also cause these long-lasting chronic things that we just we've lived with and which have remained elusive for many years now?
Yeah. You're the author of 792 peer-reviewed papers and books. Were any of those papers or books written with the benefit of AI?
No.
Well, if that is the case, and now you've wedged yourself into a corner, that indicates to me that we should be relying on experts like you far more than AI.
AI is just a computer program. It's very, very good for certain things. What it's really good at, okay, is for repetitive tasks. So basically, you train the computer program to repeat, to find repetitive events. Okay, so the more you have a repeat, the better it is. And so, you know, if you're on, if I can say the word Netflix, right, for example, and your choices come up, that's an algorithm there recognizing what you like watching. And learning from that, and then choosing, predict, you know, proposing ones for you to watch because it's learned from the previous behavior. Yeah. That's what AI does. It's really good at that. So when I look at my genomic data, it's repetitive patterns. It's really, really good for finding those quicker than other computing programs. But something that's more creative, okay, and like writing or art or media, I think AI should kind of keep out of that, right? That's a different part of the human experience. Yeah. But for just repetitive tasks, okay, it's extremely useful computer program. Mm.
Okay, Professor Eddie Holmes, congratulations on your award, and thank you for doing what you're doing, leading the world in your groundbreaking research, and thank you also for your time today on Monday Drive.
My pleasure, Alan.
Seven FM Eastside Radio.
You have been listening to Eastside Radio podcast. For selections of more enjoyable content like this, visit our website, eastsidefm.org, and click on podcast.